This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about a new museum, the only museum dedicated to the law, opening up in Connecticut.
Ralph Nader raised the money, bought an old bank building, hired a fabulous design firm, and launched this museum dedicated to tort law. What is tort law? When a person or a corporation injured somebody, they commit a tort, and juries make it better. This museum is dedicated to supporting the great democratic institution of juries.
A small town library in New Hampshire had the courage to stand up to the United States Department of Homeland Security, who wanted to snoop on the internet searches of their patrons.
Raising the fear factor, the Department of Homeland Security claimed that the library could aid criminal behavior, but the population rose up and installed the protective system.
Last week we lost one of the true people's lawyers, Attica defense attorney and so much more, Liz Fink.
For over 40 years as a criminal defense lawyer, she represented the most despised and oppressed people in this country, mainly political prisoners. And very often, she won.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael Smith, on the evening of September 22nd, we lost longtime People's Lawyer Guild member Liz Fink. Liz died of a heart attack after suffering a fractured leg. And she will be remembered by hundreds of people for her stalwart defense, especially of the Attica inmates and the civil suits that she brought after that massacre in upstate New York.
Well, she was a great criminal defense lawyer, and she specialized in prisoners' rights. The case that she devoted most of her time and energy to during her long career, she practiced law for over 40 years, was the civil case that ensued from the murder that Governor Rockefeller perpetrated on 43 prisoners in the Attica prison in upstate New York. And Liz took the civil cases. In fact, she moved up there for a number of years. She really lived up there. She financed those cases herself a lot of times off of her Visa card.
Right.
And after many, many, many years of litigation, they finally won an $8 million settlement.
In the late 90s or early 2000, I think.
Yeah. And then she gave away part of her hard-earned fee because she didn't think that the men got enough. But she vindicated these men who had done nothing but protest the terrible conditions at Attica, and Governor Rockefeller, who had presidential ambitions, refused to negotiate with the men and instead called down the state troopers to hunt them down with rifles and helicopters and tear gas and massacre them. And that tragedy so inspired Liz that she devoted years to their vindication. But that's not all she did.
I wanted to add, before we go on, Michael, that one of the inmate leaders in the takeover at Attica was Big Black, real name Frank Smith. And Big Black became Liz's investigator and paralegal. He even accompanied her to her 20th college reunion at Reed.
Yeah.
And they had what Liz called a profound relationship until he died from cancer in 2004.
Yeah. When Liz got to Reed, it was a tough place for women. But she became the president of the student body there and the head of their court system, actually. And I think she started showing even back then her inclinations toward the underdog when she was at Reed. Liz was brilliant. Reed is full of people like Liz, you know, extremely smart and able. And she devoted her energies and her intelligence to the poorest of the poor, really the underdogs in the society, the people that wind up for one reason or another in prison. And when they did, Liz could be counted on. She wrote the brief. I read it. It was brilliant. That helped Lynn Stewart.
In the sentencing of Lynn.
Yeah,
right.
In the sentencing. I mean, it was amazing because they could have It could have put Lynn away for forever, really. And Liz got the judge to give a 28-month sentence, which so aggravated the conservative forces in the Court of Appeals, they commanded that the judge give her more years, which the judge did on their orders. And she represented Jeremy Hammond,
yes,
the hacktivist.
Yes, who ended up taking a 10-year plea deal under Judge Loretta Preska. And she also convinced a jury to acquit Osama Awadallah, the San Diego State University student from Jordan, on charges of complicity in the 9/11 attacks. And I want to mention something that Liz said about that. Liz said, quote, "In the middle of that case, the prosecutor got so crazy with me, he said I was jeopardizing the republic." Then she continues, "I took that to be one of the best compliments I have ever received, jeopardizing the republic."
Yeah, jeopardizing their republic, not ours.
Right.
Liz Fink, presente. After trial lawyers told him they had no place to display exhibits they had used in court, Ralph Nader realized that there isn't a single museum devoted to the law in the United States. That's about to change. On September 26, 2015, consumer advocate Ralph Nader is opening the American Museum of Tort Law in his hometown of Winsted, Connecticut, to celebrate victories of the law and people's juries over corporate power. The museum will span the history of tort law. Tort law is civil law that seeks relief for people injured by wrongful acts of others, including corporations. And the museum will host exhibits on significant cases, such as the 1998 national settlement with tobacco companies. Nader said it will also host artifacts including the Chevrolet Corvair, the car that blew up that was featured in his 1965 book, Unsafe at Any Speed, which made him a household name. We're joined today by the attorney, political activist, two-time presidential candidate, and author Ralph Nader, who among many accomplishments is responsible for 8 major federal consumer protection laws and helped establish the Public Interest Research Group.
Ralph Nader, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Our audience members know about contract law, property law, criminal law. Tell us what tort law is.
Tort law is the law of wrongful injury. So when anybody is injured in their person or property, whether by a defective automobile, a bad side effect to a medicine, hospital malpractice, toxic exposure, even dangerous toys. Under the common law of torts in the United States, we have a remedy. We can use the law of torts, which holds perpetrators or wrongdoers that harm others intentionally or negligently accountable. And the beauty of the system of tort law is that you can decide yourself to go to a contingent fee lawyer who only gets paid if the lawyer wins, and file a case in court. You don't have to ask anybody's permission. That's the difference between the law of torts and our court system and the other two branches of government, where with the legislatures, if you want something, you got to pay or beg. And with the executive agencies, if you want them to put out a safety standard, you have to plead and ask, and it's very costly up against the corporate lobbyists who are on the other side. That's why I call the law of torts, when it's exercised, the most single dimension of direct democracy that anybody can use.
And you're opening a museum on September 26th in Winsted, Connecticut, dedicated to this idea, the American Museum of Tort Law. Tell us, what's the mission of the museum? Is it going to teach people, particularly children?
Well, it's going to educate them about both the rights they have under the law of wrongful injury to hold their wrongdoer accountable, and the duties they have under the Seventh Amendment of the Constitution to serve on juries when they're summoned. And there's very little education in the high school and colleges about this. They do a lot of focus on computer skills, but they don't educate people about the most important environment in their life, which is how the law interacts with everything they do as consumers, taxpayers, workers, people walking through environments, communities, you name it. You know, Michael, I've often been intrigued by this doctrine that we all know as lawyers, that the judges proclaim, you're presumed to know the law. If you're tripped up on arcane tax regulations or consumer issues, you're presumed to know the law. Well, if you're presumed to know the law, why don't we have tens of millions of children and students educated in the law? They can handle it. Professor Fox, who teaches at Mount Holyoke, is teaching tax law to high school students. And I asked him, Professor Fox, isn't this a little too difficult? He said, oh, no, they get it. They get it.
Tell us what some of the exhibits will be like. How will you make history animated?
Yeah, they're broken down into two categories. Cases of precedent. Those are the cases over 400 years that built the common law of torts and kept expanding people's rights. So there was a time when wrongfully injured people could not get compensation for pain and suffering. There was a time when the most criminal type of wrongdoing by a perpetrator could not be charged in a civil court of law under punitive damages. So these cases are very famous to law students. They're going to love the pictures, the color pictures of the sequence of cases like the T.J. Hooper case, for example. And one case changed the way apartment buildings secure their buildings. It was right in Washington, D.C. A woman who was a tenant walked into her apartment building and was assaulted by an intruder who got through bad security. And she sued and recovered. And that message of deterrence, which is one of the great benefits of the law of torts, resonated throughout the country, getting apartment building owners to tighten up their securities, their doors and windows and other aspects, so that they had to reach a higher standard of care. That's what it's all about.
Well, talk to us about some of the other famous cases, the flammable pajamas, the Corvair, the car that was unsafe at any speed, the tobacco litigation, the Aaron Brockovich famous case.
Yeah.
Those are all going to be in the museum, I'm sure. Talk to us a little about those, will you please?
Yeah, those are the category of cases of significance, and they really are in the memories of people because many of them are very recent. For example, hundreds of thousands of workers and sometimes their families have died from asbestos exposure, first in shipyards in World War II and then in all the other places and homes and businesses where asbestos particles get into people's lungs and create horrible mesothelioma or other cancers. And that started with a case in Tyler, Texas, where a lawyer brought a case. It was considered a very low probability case to succeed, but then it spread all over the country in class actions, and billions of dollars have flowed to these victims or their next of kin, their families, and some of the companies have gone bankrupt in order to try to escape. But it was a very creative set of strategies. In tobacco, the first case was filed in the 60s, and year after year, these cases would lose. Because the courts would say, what do you mean? This is an addiction. It's up to the victim to take care of herself or himself. But then the strategies began to develop with the lawyers, and whistleblowers began to come out from the tobacco companies. And the Surgeon General's annual report on connecting tobacco with 400-plus thousand deaths in America, they began to create a new climate. There's an old Roman adage in ancient Rome, out of the fact comes the law. And that really is what drives the evolution of the common law of torts in our country. And so the lawyers finally came upon a strategy of deception. That is, they proved that the tobacco companies knew the connection between tobacco smoking and lung cancer and other diseases, one. And two, they covered it up. and basically said to people, oh, you can smoke, it's good, it increases your concentration, you can enjoy the taste, and so on. So they began nailing him on that, and that developed such a huge level where the state attorney generals were persuaded to sue to recover the billions of dollars that Medicaid and state health disbursements had to pay out for the criminal negligence and cover-up of the tobacco company. So they settled some years ago for over $250 billion stretched out to recover some of the payments. And that led to the Congress passing a bill to regulate, in some degree, the tobacco companies from the Food and Drug Administration. So, you know, it's just one thing after another. Once the litigation passes, it encourages the proper long overdue regulation and educates the public. It generates deterrence. Smoking among adults in the U.S. Was 45% of the adults were regular smokers in 1964 when the first Surgeon General's report came out. It's now under 20%. And there are all kinds of non-smoking segments, so that the rights of non-smokers, not just on planes, buses, trains, but all over, restaurants, hospital, waiting rooms, and so forth, are now protected over the rights of smokers to pollute the air.
Ralph, I wanted to talk about the jury system, which has been under attack, probably going all the way back to Reagan. I remember when Bob Dole was running for president, and he was ridiculing people like you and me, calling us rich lawyers wearing tassel loafers. But I think the attack on tort lawyers, on personal injury lawyers, is really an attack on the jury system. And I wanted to know your thoughts on that.
Well, they focus on the trial lawyers because they don't dare focus on the hundreds of thousands of preventable deaths and millions of preventable injuries due to negligence or criminal cost-cutting by corporations and other perpetrators. So the damage done to the tort system has been huge. The number of cases filed under product liability have been declining, even though the population is increasing. Same is true for medical malpractice. The Harvard School of Public Health put out a report about 20 years ago saying that 100,000 people die every year in hospitals due to malpractice. That's 2,000 a week. Compare that with 9/11, and that's every week. And the Centers for Disease Control estimates 200 to 250 people in the U.S. die from hospital-induced infections. That is, they go to the hospital to get healed, and they pick up an infection in the hospital due to lack of washing hands and care. So the tort system has been severely damaged. That's why we want to have this tort museum, which, by the way, is the first law museum of any kind in the history of North America. There are 35,000 museums. There are dozens of medical museums, timber, lumber museums, museums on almost every fruit, vegetable, and sports and collectible. But somehow, our legal profession of over 1 million licensed lawyers hasn't come forward to demonstrate and convey through modern museum exhibits and streaming and all kinds of presentations, this great rule of law that we always talk about.
How did you get the idea for the museum? I read somewhere that lawyers have been saying to you after they put on a trial, they had no place to put their exhibits. Did this come to you over time?
Yes. In the late 90s, I was with a lawyer in Boulder, Colorado, William Trine, and came upon one of his exhibits, and I said, what do the lawyers do with all these exhibits? They're extremely expensive. They're very evocative, demonstrative. I mean, they're very well done to describe the particular tort in a court of law for judge and juries. And he said, well, they just either throw them away or toss them in a storehouse. I said, well, that's really a waste. So there should be a museum. So I got this idea. But I'll tell you, it has been a huge haul just to raise the $3 million from around the country. Foundations are not interested in it. Look who the Board of Trustees are, most foundations. They're corporate executives or corporate lawyers. And the government, we don't take government money for this. So it's been a very difficult haul. And September 26th is the culmination, and we're very pleased that it's going to be a packed house. There's great media interest, and we're going to establish this educational institution, not just for the general public, but for students. If they have dramatic clubs, we want them to reenact famous cases. We're expanding the museum. Stage two is a full-size courtroom for expanded presentations every day. There's a lot of things going on in cases and courts all over the country that people never see the day of. And it's very important because one of the purposes of tort law is disclosing defects that have been hidden by corporations. It was the case in Texas that launched the exposure of the GM ignition switch defect, for example. And there are thousands of examples like that where the regulatory agencies, the legislature, sleep on the job or indentured to special interests, and they have to be jolted by these lawyers representing plaintiffs under the tort system.
I think this sounds like a wonderful opportunity, not only for high school students, but law students and colleges to come visit. I also imagine a lot of people will want to meet you. How often are you going to be at the museum?
Well, you know, there's a lot going on in Washington you have to keep tabs on, but I'll be there once in a while. I'd like to help with the kinds of presentations that are going on. I mean, there are things that are really amazing. There's a law firm in Philadelphia where the lawyers win the case. They go and demand recall of the vehicles, for example. They also publicize the case in book form. And one of them is teaching a course at University of Pennsylvania Law School and now Stanford in Bolt Hall in Berkeley, titled Civil Justice as an Instrument of Social Change. So who knows that? The big fire in Providence, that horrible fire years ago in the nightclub, the lawyers who took those cases, one of them is now going around the country with a 90-minute presentation to people who are concerned about fires in theaters and nightclubs. Who knows about that?
Fascinating.
So the function of tort law is compensation for the wrongfully injured person, disclosure to the public of the wider range of defects in the same condition or product, deterrence so that companies in that position clean up their act, and, of course, holding perpetrators accountable. That's what the American people want, and we've got to tell the truth about the civil justice system. And one of them is it's greatly underutilized. Not 10% of wrongfully injured people even use the civil justice system.
Well, at least they can get a lawyer on a contingent basis, which didn't used to be allowed. You know, Heidi used to be the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, and I've been a member for many years. And it was the generation before us, really, that got so involved in tort law. I think it grew out of the workers' compensation bar. There was worker compensation was brought in, I think, in 1937, and the lawyers that were representing injured workers then started doing negligence cases. And a lot of those people were members and founding members of the National Lawyers Guild. So this is something that's been dear to our hearts. And I wanted to ask you about not only the contingent fee, but the doctrine of contributory negligence, because that used to be a total bar to recovery for a plaintiff, and now we have, in most places, comparative negligence. So it allows people to reach juries a lot easier. And I wanted to ask you about your reflections on that.
Yeah, there's a case in the Tort Museum just on that, the first case breakthrough. It used to be that if someone smashed into you negligently, they would get off if you were partly negligent. So if they were like 90% negligent, you were 10%, that was a defense by the perpetrator. They say, oh, well, you know, that person wasn't that careful as well. So in the evolution of the common law of torts, lawyers started to say, hey, why don't you set one off against another? And you don't just get rid of the whole case. Somebody's paraplegic, was a little bit careless, but nothing compared to the perpetrator that hit him or her. So that's an example of how the common law of torts expands through reason and through fact gradually. As the former dean of Harvard Law School, Roscoe Pound, once said, the common law has to be stable, but also has to change.
Ralph, I understand that Eisterhold Associates has designed the museum. Can you talk about their work a bit?
Yeah, they designed the Tolerance Museum. They worked on the Rosa Parks Museum. They are extremely sensitive to new kinds of museums that are communicating social justice movements. You know, most museums focus on very specific things, like their museum of art, there's a museum of fish, ocean fish, there's museums on particular cities where they're located, historical museums, but they like to see civil rights. There should be museums on that, and they're very good that way. We're very proud to have them, and we hope to have them for the expansion of the Tort Museum here.
Do you have a website for the museum yet?
Yes, it's tortmuseum.org.
Say that again.
Tortmuseum.org. People said, why you call it Tort Museum? Nobody knows what a tort is. I say, yeah, ask the insurance industry.
Oh, simple is always very elegant and memorable.
Well, Ralph Nader, your career has been so admirable to all of us attorneys and citizens, and we're so grateful for you to be on Law and Disorder, and we wanted to ask you if you have any concluding thoughts for us.
Yes, it's often said that the tort system, by compensating victims, holding perpetrators accountable, disclosing and deterring bad behavior, is just a health and safety law. But, you know, on a larger scale, it protects our freedom. If Marcus Cicero's freedom over 2,000 years ago, he defined freedom as, quote, participation in power, end quote. And if you can go to court and take on General Motors and BP and Pfizer and Citigroup and others in a court of law where you can cross-examine top executives, where you have a lawyer on a contingent fee, where you can be tried by a jury of your peers, that is the best definition going in the USA. Freedom is participation in power.
A great way to end this interview, Ralph Nader. Congratulations for opening up the American Museum of Tort Law in Winsted, Connecticut. You can all go there starting September 26th. Patti Smith's going to be there to launch it, and we recommend it to everybody, and we're going to be there as soon as we can get out of New York City. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Ralph.
And so will former Attorney General Ramsey Clark and Senator Richard Blumenthal.
Oh, excellent. Wonderful.
Yeah, Ramsey's a friend of ours. He's been on the show. And we're looking forward to going up there and then reporting back to our audience, which is nationwide, about what we saw. So congratulations again, Ralph Nader, for doing this great work.
Thank you. And thank Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
With a population just above 13,000 people, the quaint town of Lebanon, New Hampshire, is nestled not far from the Connecticut River, in the northwest corner of the state, just a few miles from Dartmouth College. In July, the local library set up a system to protect the privacy of patrons using its computers by installing Tor, the platform that routes users' internet traffic through various relay points, making warrantless surveillance of browsing habits and traffic more difficult. The Kilton Library's Tor relay node attracted the attention of the Department of Homeland Security, which contacted local officials and law enforcement, warning that Tor could aid criminal behavior. In response, the library initially took down the relay, but after a groundswell of public support, reinstalled it. Joining us today to talk about this principled stand is Allison Macrina, director of the Library Freedom Project, who helped to set up the Tor relay node at the library. Allison, welcome to Law and Disorder. Allison, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
You work with the Library Freedom Project. Tell us a bit about what you do.
Well, Library Freedom Project is an initiative that aims to make real the promise of intellectual freedom in libraries. And I am the director of the Library Freedom Project, and I founded it just a little bit after the Snowden revelations became public. And what we do at Library Freedom Project, we travel all over the country and increasingly internationally. We teach librarians about the surveillance state, their right to privacy under the law, and various law reform efforts that are happening, and about technology that they can use either to install on their public computers or teach to their patrons in the kind of free computer classes that libraries already offer. So we work with the ACLU, particularly the ACLU Massachusetts, where we started the project, and also with the Tor Project, the technologists who make tools like Tor Browser that we teach in the technology part of the class. So that's pretty much the basis of our work, and we have a number of different special projects kind of here and there.
Okay, this sounds like a dream job. How fabulous.
What a troublemaker you are.
Yeah, I love this. We were especially interested, because I come from a few miles from Lebanon, New Hampshire, in the bravery of a small library who was contacted by the Department of Homeland Security. Can you tell our listeners what happened?
Yes. So we got working on a new project, a new Library Freedom Project initiative, running Tor exit relays in libraries. I devised this project with one of Library Freedom Project's staff, a guy named Nima Fatemi, who is a longtime Tor Project volunteer, an amazing Iranian security researcher and cypherpunk. He and I came up with the project and decided libraries are really the ideal places to run these relays. We have the bandwidth to devote to Tor Network. It doesn't take that much, but we can use some of our unused bandwidth for it. We're already these places where people associate privacy and intellectual freedom, and we think it's a great use of the commons. So the reason why we decided to have our pilot library at Kilton Library in Lebanon, New Hampshire, was because we'd already had a relationship with this library. Library Freedom Project had been there a few times with the ACLU of New Hampshire. We'd done a few privacy trainings. The IT librarian there, Chuck McAndrew, has done some really incredible stuff to his library PC environment. He has all of his computers running on different GNU Linux distributions, which is really remarkable when you consider that most libraries use Windows. And Windows, of course, is owned by Microsoft, which was one of the biggest participants in the PRISM program, you know, among other various privacy violations, and they're also just kind of an evil corporation. So Chuck, you know, already had the right idea about his computer environment. We approached him about this project. He was totally on board. His director, Sean Fleming, was also really enthusiastic. They put it to a board vote. The board was unanimous. It was just so much overwhelming excitement about the potential of this project, both in the practical sense and in the more kind of ideological, warm, fuzzy, happy intellectual freedom sense. So we got started on the project in July. We set up the pilot. We had it as a middle relay and not an exit relay, which was the eventual goal.
And can you explain what that means for listeners?
Yes. Tor is does a few different things. Most people use Tor through the Tor browser, which anonymizes your IP address to the internet. It makes it so that some of your personally identifiable information can't be ascertained by anyone who's observing your network activity. So Tor does this by bouncing your traffic through a network of relays. These relays are just computers. They are run by volunteers all over the world. That's one of the strengths of the Tor network, is that it is totally decentralized. It's a great, amazing global community effort. And it's one reason why we want libraries to participate, because they are a community effort at the local level. So the middle relay is one that just sort of pushes the traffic along in this little relay circuit. The exit is the only one on this circuit that is identifiable. So in other words, someone is using Tor browser, her IP address will match that of the exit relay that her traffic is left out of. So this is really essential. You consider it's the only one identifiable, so it's sort of accountable a little bit more than the other relays are. And that's one reason why we think libraries are the ideal places to run these relays, is because we're already institutions that provide public internet access and other services. We are shielded from some of the legal concerns that an individual might face if she was running one of these relays. For example, like, you might get a copyright notice about some of the traffic that leaves your relay. Well, if you're an individual, explaining that to law enforcement might be a little harder than a library that gets these things all the time. So we set this up in July, and we got a great amount of media attention. The public was super supportive. It was really wonderful. It was like everyone seemed to get our idea why this was so essential, and everyone was so excited about this library, and we got to showcase some of the really special qualities of Lebanon libraries and of the Kilton branch where we set the relay up.
When they started doing it in the Kilton library, the Department of Homeland Security raised the fear factor here.
So tell
us the story of how you got that reversed.
Yeah, well, basically, a few weeks later, the library got, as you said, Department of Homeland Security, the Boston field office, contacted the local police in New Hampshire and shared one of the media stories that had come out about their relay. And immediately the police went to the library and said, I don't actually know exactly what was said, but they were spreading some uncertainty and doubt and, suggesting that Tor is only for criminal activities. So the relay was suspended. So what we did next was we mobilized the ACLU of Massachusetts, the ACLU of New Hampshire, the folks who are working on Library Freedom Project, and the folks at Tor Project, as well as involving the library in our methods, because we didn't want to do anything that would be, we wanted to respect their autonomy and give them the support that they needed in making the right decision, because they voluntarily suspended it at this law enforcement pressure. We wanted to make the case for keeping it up, but we didn't want to get in their way. So we mobilized all the support. We got a great piece by Julia Angwin in ProPublica telling the whole story of what happened at Kilton. And then it just totally erupted into this incredible global community display of solidarity with this library, encouragement, and support for Tor. We got a petition that Electronic Frontier Foundation set up for us, and in just a few days, we got almost 4,500 signatures. We wrote, Library Freedom Project, ACLU, and Tor wrote an open letter to the library supporting them. We got a whole bunch of different, a very broad coalition of public service organizations signed on to that, like Freedom of the Press Foundation and Free Software Foundation and all these other folks. And most remarkably, the attention that the library got at the local level, they got dozens of emails. I understand that only one of them was negative. They had this huge response. Many people from Lebanon and the surrounding towns said, we love the library for even being involved in this. We totally want you to bring this relay back up. We think that this is an incredible symbolic and also practical thing for libraries to be doing. I mean, it was just this huge community response. So then we had a board meeting. The library's board was set to meet on September 15th to decide what to do about the relay. And Nima and I arrived at the board meeting and immediately saw people outside with signs that said, like, you know, down with Big Brother and DHS out of my library and we love Tor, and it was awesome. And then we go in and there's just several dozen people in there who all shared their own experiences using Tor and the reasons why they think Tor is important for global internet freedom and for this community. And it was massive. And then even the board, when they spoke, they had been educating themselves a lot more about what Tor is. They were all super supportive. It was like we didn't have a single dissenting voice, and I kind of wish that we had, right? Because I want it to be direct democracy. But it was just, I've never seen anything quite like it. It was amazing.
Allison, how many other libraries across the nation are going to be starting to use Tor, in your opinion?
Well, we've heard from about a dozen libraries who have been catalyzed into action after this, all the DHS attention. I mean, the Streisand effect is a real thing. So our first step is to finish the pilot at Kilton. We got the relay turned back on. It was a great victory, but we're not done yet. We still have to turn it into an exit. They have to make some changes on their network. We want to make sure everything goes really smoothly there. Once that is finished, our plan is to have our kind of beta round with maybe five or so libraries. And then we'll keep going as such. But yeah, so far we've heard from about a dozen. There's a huge conversation happening in the library community now about how we can do this at scale, other ideas people have for supporting Tor if they maybe don't have the bandwidth to run a relay. And so I think that not only will we see a number of libraries sign on to the project, but we're going to see more support in creative ways. You know, maybe that means people offering Tor browser on the library computers or on a flash drive that someone can just use on the spot. But yeah, it's engendered an overwhelming library response too.
Allison, what are the core values of librarians and of the Library Freedom Project, and how does this relate to democracy?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. I love that question. So librarians, the American Library Association codified our core values statement in 1939. And among those core values, we have actually democracy is one of them. So that's kind of a broad overarching theme, you know, if nothing else that. But also intellectual freedom, you know, the right to read, write, and research freely without fear of reprisal. Privacy is one of those core values. And then a number of other things that fit really closely with those. It's very close to the Constitution, effectively. It's about equity and, you know, all these lovely ideas. And as far as Library Freedom Project, I mean, I think of us as a kind of ACLU for the library world. Our goal is to keep libraries beholden to those democratic core values. So, you know, intellectual freedom being the biggest one, but privacy is so essential to intellectual freedom that they're very intrinsically linked.
Well, is there a threat of terrorism that you perceive? Isn't this what the people who want to monitor the use of library computers are saying, that there's this real threat of terrorism, and you people, under the guise of civil liberties, are endangering the country? What do you respond to that?
Well, it's actually more likely that you'll get killed by your household furniture than you'll get killed by terrorists. So my friend Cade Crockford at the ACLU loves to throw that one out, and we're like, when is the war on furniture going to start? But truly, you know, I don't mean to trivialize it. I understand why people are afraid of big national security threats and all these things. What I do want to say is that I think that we've been misled about the relationship between the erosion of our digital our civil liberties generally and fighting terrorism. And obviously, Ben Franklin predicted this way back when. But the example that I think of most often is, you know, when Keith Alexander was pressed after the Snowden revelations, when he was asked to say, you know, how many terrorist attacks have been thwarted by mass surveillance? Tell us a number. And at first, I think he said something like 54. And then he was pressed further, and then the number dropped to like 30-something, and then the number dropped again, and then the number dropped again, and eventually he landed at one. And the one example he can give of, you know, mass surveillance preventing a terrorist attack is that guy in, I think it was in Los Angeles, he was a taxi driver. He was maybe materially supporting terrorists by sending money to Al-Shabaab, but it's sort of a specious connection. So I like giving that example because, you know, we know that there is no proven connection between increased civil liberties erosion and more surveillance and terrorism. And I actually live in the city where the most recent terrorist attack happened. I live in Boston. And we know that the FBI and the local police and the Joint Terrorism Task Force had years of surveillance and monitoring of Tamerlan Tsarnaev, and that didn't do anything to prevent him from bombing the Boston Marathon. You know, if anything, I think that it makes law enforcement less able to do their jobs. Even if there was a good relationship, it's still not worth it. You know, the things that are worth fighting for are those very democratic values, and the people who are really threatening them are not terrorists at all, but the kind of people who want to increase our surveillance state, you know, further the powers of our 17 intelligence agencies and our military, further privatize our public spaces. You know, those are the things that I'm worried about. Those are the real terrorists, as far as I'm concerned.
So who is Keith Alexander? Remind us. And then what did Benjamin Franklin say?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I'm like all over the place. So Keith Alexander is the former director of the NSA. And Ben Franklin's quote is, it's been butchered a number of times, so I'll just paraphrase it. Basically, he says, those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety.
Allison, I have a question about the level of digital literacy of most librarians in this country. We know about Chuck from the Lebanon Library, who seems very literate electronically, but is that the norm for librarians across the country? I'm just wondering how receptive, if this Tor Project idea spreads, will you have the kind of support among libraries?
Yeah, Chuck, I think, is certainly remarkable in his technical abilities, but he's not at all a rarity in libraries. And the other thing, too, is that librarians generally have a pretty high level of digital literacy. One of the biggest parts of our jobs that I think many people don't realize is we spend a huge amount of the day doing helping people with their kind of technical literacy needs. So we're very clued in to how ordinary people interact with their computers and the kind of questions they have. And also, libraries are increasingly more technological spaces. Most libraries have a systems librarian or a technology librarian who's working there. And this is maybe only not true for really tiny places. But bear in mind, Lebanon Libraries is not a huge system. I mean, they have two branches. They're in a kind of quiet part of New Hampshire, and they still have somebody on staff with these really great tech skills. So, yeah, we're pretty confident that we're going to find people like Chuck everywhere, and folks certainly don't need to have his level of technical skill. I mean, we want them to know, you know, the basics of how to keep the relay operating properly, but they can be a few notches below him and their technical abilities. The other thing, too, is that our privacy trainings that we do all over the country with the ACLU, we can't keep up with the demand for those. We're looking for more funding now so we can hire another person to come and help us, because the response from librarians has been really overwhelming. And those workshops are largely technical. I mean, it's a lot of learning how to use Tor Browser, learning how to use Tails, the anonymous operating system, learning how to use various other digital tools like VPNs and things like that. So I think that librarians' technical skills are something that's sort of surprising to people when they come from outside libraries and observe what we're able to do.
What about librarians? I mean, they really seem to me to be an amazing group of people. They resisted the Patriot Act when they were told to turn over certain information about the users of libraries. And they've really been out front. I mean, am I wrong about that?
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. We have a great history of activism around, particularly around privacy, because we recognize it as so essential. It's so connected to our biggest value of intellectual freedom. We were some of the first to oppose the first national security letter challenge, which was multiple plaintiffs, but librarians were among them, challenging the constitutionality of the gag orders that are attached to NSLs. So NSLs are an information request that you might get that says you have to give us this information about your patrons and you're not allowed to tell anyone that you got it. Librarians in Connecticut enlisted the help of the ACLU of Connecticut, and the FBI eventually dropped the suit against them. So there was that. Also, a little lesser known resistance movement among librarians was against a program, a late Cold War program called the Library Awareness Program. There's a great book written about this called Surveillance in the Stacks. And this was an FBI, a clandestine FBI surveillance program of libraries and their patrons, because what they allege is that they believed that libraries were secret KGB recruitment centers, and that librarians were secret KGB agents, and that so we were like spying. I'm not making this up either. You can read this book and see. And when we found out about this, there was an incredible amount of outrage from the ALA. There were statements issued. So we've been targeted by these things before, and every time there's a major privacy battle in the public arena, we are up front and center. And the Snowden stuff is no different. I mean, I started Library Freedom Project after Snowden came forward about NSA mass surveillance, and what I found immediately was that my colleagues were incredibly receptive to the workshops that we started leading. They wanted to know ways to fight back. They were outraged. They wanted to bring this information to their communities. And I think that, you know, one reason why you see this level of resistance from librarians is that we serve members of all communities, especially in public libraries. So we especially recognize that members of historically marginalized groups, Muslims, immigrants, people of color generally, political activists, are and have been under a great deal more surveillance than the general population. And these are the people that we serve in libraries. They use libraries more than the general population. So I think we recognize how the material effects on our patrons. I think, and also we see this as a kind of bigger existential problem for libraries, where surveillance is part of bigger issues of injustice, the privatization of public space, the destruction of the public commons, and we are the public commons, so we have to fight back about this because it means so much to exactly who we are.
That's so beautifully put, Allison. I wanted to ask you, I remember after the events of 9/11, we heard about several libraries who couldn't be or didn't want to be in violation of laws at the time, where they weren't allowed to divulge whether someone from DHS, Department of Homeland Security, maybe had come in and asked about the habits of a particular person. So they would put up signs saying, "Today, DHS didn't visit." Is that still happening anywhere?
Yeah, actually. So what you're thinking of are some of the first warrant canaries. This is what they're referred to now. You know, it's like the canary in a coal mine. If the canary stops singing, you got to get the heck out of the coal mine. You put these signs up, and as soon as you get a visit from the intelligence agencies or law enforcement, you take the sign down. I don't know how many libraries are still using those, but the librarian who came up with them is a woman named Jessamine West. And she was successful in getting a lot of libraries to adopt those. And actually, it's one thing that I teach with the ACLU. So the ACLU's part of our trainings is sort of, you know, not just the law as it exists, but law reform efforts that are in the works, what people need to know about them, what that means for local privacy and federal level privacy stuff, and then kind of like a know your rights, what to do when sort of training. So if you get a warrant in the library, how to read that, what to look for. And national security letters are a big part of that, because we want librarians to know that we have gotten these in the past, that we could get them again, and what to do if they come up. And then the warrant canary thing is, you know, some people think that that's like meaningless security theater or whatever, but I actually really love those, because I love it as a tool for teaching the public that these things are a very real threat, you know, that we might get one. So if you have a sign up in your library that says, "The FBI has not been here today, watch very closely for this sign to be removed," you're going to get some questions about that. And I think it's a great sort of conversation starter.
I'll say. Speaking with Allison McQuina of the Library Freedom Project. Allison, do you have a website for our listeners?
I do. It is libraryfreedomproject.org, and for any nerds who care, it is on HTTPS by default.
You know, what are your observations about what's happened to this country since 9/11? What do you think's going on now with respect to fear and the surveillance state?
That is the political policy of the last 15 years, and I would say it goes back even further than September 11th and the war on terror. I mean, the drug war made the war on terror sort of shovel ready. You know, for many people in this country, they had already been governed by these policies of fear and othering of certain groups. You know, Black Americans in particular have been subject to mass incarceration and mandatory minimum sentencing for nonviolent drug offenses. I mean, we have a crisis. You know, talk about rights violations. You know, there are people who are being put in cages for, you know, double-digit sentences for something that they did in their personal lives. So, you know, I think that is all about fear. That's about the, you know, kind of boogeyman of drugs and what they might do to us if we let normal people use them on their own time. But it's extended to the rest of the globe to a degree that it had not before. And so, you know, what I'm really afraid of is the material effect on marginalized people, the effects of the war on drugs and the war on terror, specifically on people of color and on Muslims generally. I speak to a lot of librarians who work very closely with Muslim populations. And, you know, you want to talk about the erosion of intellectual freedom. Muslims have stopped attending mosques. They have signs up that say, you know, don't talk about politics here. You know, read this sign if you want to know why. There are programs in Muslim communities like Countering Violent Extremism, which is an FBI program that essentially, it's like trying to get Muslims to inform on each other for perceived radicalism, and the questions they ask are totally ludicrous. It's like, do you trust the government? Are you very religious? Well, as a white person, if I answered those, or a white non-Muslim, I should say, I would not necessarily be suspect. But, you know, any criticism of their government is deemed to be something very suspicious. So I'm afraid of what this means for our democracy. You know, not that I thought it was perfect at all to begin with, but it's amazing to me that wanting to, you know, defend and protect the Constitution and for people to have their constitutionally guaranteed rights, it's amazing to me that that is a radical act in 2015.
Allison, we're unfortunately running out of time, but we love the Library Freedom Project fine work you're doing, and we look forward to having you back on when we have more libraries across the nation protecting their information.
Oh, yeah, I'm happy to come back on and tell you about all those when we get them started. I'd love to.
Allison, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Allison.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Have a good
day.
Bye.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.